Ben-Gurion International Airport is a brash, beautiful, strikingly confident construction that, like much of Tel Aviv, looks as though it might have sprouted fully formed from the desert sands of the old Arab port city of Jaffa. Named after the surly general and chief architect of the state, the airport is a testament to Israel's self-ascribed position as a bastion of social and technological advancement amid a sea of inchoate enemies. In fact, Ben-Gurion's primary function seems to be to filter out those very enemies by tightly controlling access to the state. This is true of all international airports, I suppose, as anyone who has undergone the humiliation of being scanned, fingerprinted, and photographed to be allowed entry into the United States post-9/11 can attest. In the modern world, airports have become a kind of identity directory, the place where we are most determinately defined, registered, and catalogued before being apportioned into separate queues, each according to nationality. Still, Israel has, for obvious reasons, taken this process to new and unprecedented heights. I am not two steps off the plane when I am immediately tagged and separated from the rush of passengers by a pimpled immigration officer in a knitted yarmulke. "Passport, please," he barks. "Why are you here?" I cannot tell him the truth. I want to sneak into Gaza, which has been sealed off for months. In 2006, when Palestinians were offered their first taste of a free and fair election, they voted overwhelmingly for the religious nationalists of Hamas over the more secular yet seemingly inept politicians of Fatah, the party founded by Yasser Arafat in 1958. Despite having promised to allow the Palestinians self-determination, Israel, the United States, and the European powers quickly decided that Hamas, whose founding charter refuses to recognize the State of Israel and whose militant wing, the Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades, has been responsible for countless Israeli military and civilian deaths, would not be allowed to govern. Gaza, the sliver of fallow land that has become Hamas's de facto stronghold, was cut off from the outside world. International aid dried up and a plan was put in place to, as the New York Times put it, starve the Palestinian Authority of money and international connections to the point where new elections would have to be held. This resulted in a violent rift between Hamas and Fatah that split the occupied territories in two. The West Bank, governed by Fatah with the aid of Israel and the Western powers, and Gaza, ruled by Hamas and isolated from the rest of the world, a prison with 1.5 million hungry, fuming inmates. I wanted to visit the ruined village of al-Nasr in northern Gaza, some miles away from lush Tel Aviv. A few months earlier, a number of villagers, including two toddlers, had drowned in what the press was calling a sewage tsunami. The deluge had been triggered by the collapse of a treatment facility just above the village that had been slowly and steadily leaking sewage. For months, the villagers of al-Nasr had pleaded with Israeli authorities to allow the importation of the pumps, pipes, and filters necessary to stem the flow. But Israel, rattled by a ceaseless barrage of crudely constructed rockets launched daily from Gaza, some of which were, in the sort of grim irony that can exist only in such a place, constructed from old sewage pipes, refused. The villagers built an earthen embankment around what was fast becoming a giant lake of human waste. But the embankment would not hold. On the morning of March 27, 2007, while most of the villagers of al-Nasr slept, the embankment gave way. The village was inundated. This is what we talk about when we talk about Gaza, that human beings, men, women, children, could literally drown in shit. "Why are you here?" "To visit the sites," I say. It is not a satisfactory answer, and I am taken into a windowless room where the question is repeated, this time by a slightly older officer. An hour passes, and a third officer walks in with the same question. "Why are you here?" Thereafter, the question is repeated, in the sterile immigration office, in a smaller, even more sterile office inside the first office, in an even smaller office inside that office, and later at the immigration queue, at the baggage claim, at customs, until I come to think of "why are you here" as a form of greeting. All of this is understandable. I resent none of it. Though I am a citizen of the United States, I was born in Iran and have spent a great deal of time in countries that do not even recognize Israel's right to exist. Countries that, were I to have an Israeli stamp on my passport, would not allow me to enter their borders, would maybe even cart me off to jail. Israel has every reason to be cautious, considering the battering it has received at the hands of people who look just like me. The problem is not with Israel. The problem is with me, with the sum of my identities. My citizenship is American. My nationality, Iranian. My ethnicity, Persian. My culture, Middle Eastern. My religion, Muslim. My gender, male. All the multiple signifiers of my identity, the things that make me who I am, are in one way or another viewed as a threat to the endless procession of perfectly pleasant, perfectly reasonable immigration officers whose task it is to maintain a safe distance between people like them and people like me. Even so, throughout the entire exercise, I could not help but think of the famed French theorist Ernest Renan, who once defined the nation as a group of people united in a mistaken view about the past and a hatred of their neighbors. Nowhere is that sentiment borne out more fully or with more force than among the nations scattered along the broad horizon of the Middle East. Perhaps it should come as no surprise, then, that the region in which nationalism arose so late and so often through the will of others is the region in which it is now being most unmistakably subsumed by the tide of globalization.